I'm an addict. My name is Marvin. They got enough microphones up here. Look like a Senate hearing committee. Man, it's good. Isn't it good to be back down in Ocean City again? Caprica 32. I was walking around earlier, and I was looking at the banners, and my very first NA convention was Caprica 2 in Crystal City. I was about some months clean. I got clean November 30th, 1987. The convention was in March of 88. I had a sponsor who told me to go and meet him there. And back then, you didn't have cell phones. Everything was a landline. I got there. I didn't know but about a handful of people. But it was the best weekend of my life. So if this is your first convention, you are in store for something that you have never had before. Is this mine? Now, I want to do a couple of things and get a couple of things out of the way, and then we're going to fly this plane. But before we do, I want to ask everybody to just have a moment of silence. I got a phone call from my mom today, and she was telling me about a friend of mine that he couldn't stop using, and he OD'd and he died. And that just kind of brought some things back to this disease that we suffer from and carry every day doesn't care anything about us. Now, we can play with it, we can get a little cocky with it, and we can try and ignore it, but it got your name and your number, and it's after you, just like me. So if we can pause for a moment of silence. Thank you. Again, I'm an addict. My name is Marvin. And I want to say some thank yous to the programming committee and the host committee and the D.C. area for Caprica 32 for asking me to come and share my experience, strength, and hopes. So I want to thank you all that's behind me. Thank you for all the work that you've done over the last year in putting this together. This is no small plight. We come down every year and enjoy the harvest of the labor of the people that don't get all of the recognition. So thank you for allowing me to come and share. I'm going to run through a couple of things. I want to thank my sponsor who's here, and certainly he and I have had this year, we've had some good step study time. We've gone through the how it works, how and why, and been doing a lot of work. So I'd like to thank Keith, and we've also spent some time with his sponsor, Washington, and done some work. I got some sponsees that have been doing some step work. Rob over there, and John, and Rayshawn is somewhere out here. Thank y'all. Now, my home group, we meet every Friday night at 7 o'clock, Jumpstart to Recovery, Washington, D.C., number 25, 53rd Street, Northeast Washington, D.C., 219. If you're ever in the area, come out to Jumpstart to Recovery. Home group members, Jackie, Val, Sherman, JD, thank y'all. And thank everybody that's been here for me in this process over the last 30 years. And I'd like to thank y'all. Now, we got all of the preliminaries out the way. So nobody can go home and be mad, right? Because we didn't thank everybody. If I didn't call your name, you was thanked. Now, I saved the best for last. My wife, who have traveled with me and have been with me for 27 years of this process, and that ain't an easy thing to do. I'd like to thank my wife, whom I love, who has been the love of my life, the mother of my children, and thank you for all that you have done and do. Now, I don't have no girlfriends to thank. All right. I got one wife. Now, listen to this. I got clean at the age of 23 years old, and I didn't think that I was even going to live till I was 25. I had been putting a lot of combinations together, doing a little bit of this with a little bit of that, and a little bit of that with a little bit of this, and you start waking up and it's not working anymore. And you know how it is when we come toward the end of the road, when the getting high isn't even getting high, it's just enough to get you to function so you can go and try to do a little something else so that you can get high. So that was kind of the end of the road for me. It wasn't about using to get high anymore, because I couldn't even get high when I first got up. You ever went through addiction and you start telling yourself you're not going to use, you're going to stay in the house, and because there were landlines back then, you start saying, I'm not going to answer the telephone. If somebody knock on the door, I'm not going to answer the door because I don't want to get high. I couldn't understand how I couldn't stay stopped. I didn't understand that what I had was this thing called a disease. And even today, what it does to me is that it comes into my life in other forms and other areas of my life. It kind of backdoor itself sometimes. And now the disease starts to make me at a place of a dis-ease. So I'm not easy with a lot of stuff. And left to my own devices, what I will do is start to give in to the obsession and the compulsion that I live with every day. Now, I don't give in to the narcotics because the narcotics doesn't plague me like it used to. But it starts to take me into other areas that start to become a problem because, remember, I suffer from this dis-ease that says that it doesn't matter what you're doing as long as it makes me feel good and can change my mood. So now I start to give in to some of this stuff. But before the narcotics, I couldn't understand the little boy that was growing up. Now, I was born on the 4th of July. I didn't like that. Somebody else, huh? I didn't like it. I was born that July in South Carolina. We moved to D.C. in December of the same year. I didn't have anything that I could accept about me. I had a father and a mother that was married till my father passed away in 2008. I was looking at the banners, and I remembered in 2008 I didn't come because in April of that year, April 1st, he was diagnosed with aggressive cancer, lung cancer, and he died in July. And I still, to this day, miss him. Now, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the relationship with my father. Can I take this sweat hood off? Because we're getting ready to fly this plane. All right, now, all right, I was born in July, moved to D.C. in December, and can you remember when you go to school and you had to do the little tests and you had to grid and shade in the circles of your name and where you was born and how old you were and what's your month, date, and birth, and I would tell on the test I was born in New York because I wasn't comfortable telling you all anymore that I was born in South Carolina because you made jokes about people that was born in South Carolina and you called us country. And I couldn't accept that because I didn't have a high enough esteem about myself and my self-worth was dependent upon what you thought and felt about me today. So if you didn't like me today, then I didn't like me today. And if you thought that I was cool today, then I felt that I was cool. So I knew that you wouldn't bother me if I said I was born from New York, simply because New York had always been rough and tough. And South Carolina was being called country, and you couldn't call New York country. So I was born in New York. I was born in Manhattan, around about Harlem area. I had the story, and you all didn't know, you wasn't the wise of it. My father lived with us, and he was a disciplinary man, and I couldn't understand why he kept coming home. Because it seemed like people who didn't have fathers in the house could do a little more than what I could do. You could stay out beyond the streetlights coming on. You could smoke a cigarette that we would find, because we were young, so we would find cigarettes on the ground, and we would smoke them. And if my father smelled the cigarette smoke on me, then that means I'm going to be grounded. I couldn't come back outside. So I was always scared to do a lot of stuff. He was a man that was going to church. He would take his family to church. He was a man that would pray. We would say grace at dinner time. I couldn't understand that. That wasn't cool. I had some buddies that had a father that didn't live there. He had a pool hall uptown. We would catch the bus. And you remember how you board the back of the bus and not pay the fare? We would board the back of the bus and go uptown to my buddy's father's pool hall. When I got up on U Street, I was about 9 years old. And when I got up on U Street, I said, this is where I want to be. I'm not going to leave until I made my mark. Now, what I didn't know is making the mark would have me here with you tonight. I kept sneaking away. I would do this thing that you call run away, but come back around nighttime when it's about dinner time. So I'd run away. You know, I'd cut class. You know, I didn't have a problem doing the work. I had all my brothers are older than me, so I could always catch up on the work. I was offered to be skipped 2 times. And each time I says, no, I'll stay with my friends. Because going to another grade and having no friends was unfamiliar territory to me. And I don't do well in unfamiliar territory. I saw that as a kid. I didn't do well in that. So I wouldn't accept the skip. I would cry and tell my mom I don't want to be skipped, so the school wouldn't do it. They offered it twice to me. And each time I said no. But it was because you all made the difference in my life. You all kept telling me what I was going to be, how I was going to be, and I bought into all of the negativity and all of the nonsense around that. I had no idea, I had no understanding of who I was inside. All I knew is that I was hurt and I was broken. I was the youngest, I was blocked, we were living in the projects, I had a father living with me, my mother was the disciplinary, I stayed in trouble, and I always got beatings by this woman. My mother was the kind of woman out of the South that believed I'm not going to beat you with your clothes on because I bought the clothes. So she would tell you to take the clothes off, pick the belt, do not get the small belt, because if you get the small one, she's going to give you 2 beatings. And she would beat me, and I used to stand there, and I learned how not to cry. I grew up telling myself I'm never going to date anybody like my mother. I didn't like women that had a lot of mouth. I didn't like women that was domineering. I didn't like women that was opinionated. I wanted you merely mousy, and I ran the show, and I was always in control. Because somewhere around about 14, 15, y'all started calling me fats, and that thing had resonated with me, and it reminded me of Minnesota Fats the Pool Shop. I was reading books like Iceberg Slim and Donald Gordon. My mother used to take the books and throw them in the trash, and I'd go to another library and get them some more. I started reading Donald Goins' The Dope Fiend, and I said, that's me. There was these 4 sisters that lived across the hall for us in the projects, and all 4 of them was prostitutes, and the pimp used to come around and pick them up. He would pick them up, and he'd see me, and he'd say, hey, little man, you doing all right? And I'd tell him, yeah, man, I'm doing all right. And he'd flip me 50 cents, and I'd go out and I'd buy everybody on the block some cookies, because back then you'd get 2 cookies for a penny. So I had 50 cents. I'd get a whole lot of cookies and a whole lot of friends. So I was the big cheese on the block. So he'd flip me 50 cents. I'd take everybody to the candy lady, and I'd stand in the back, and Miss Murray would ask everybody what you want, and I'd tell Miss Murray, the bill is on me. Take care of everybody, Miss Murray. And I went right through addiction doing the same thing. The bill is on me. Take care of everybody. I got this. But listen, as I got here, no, before I got here, I'm in addiction. And I'm using. And it's like 74, and the guys from NAM had come home, and they said, hey, little man, why don't you try this? And I said, no, because I had a father. I had a father in the house. And I said, no, I can't try it. And they said, man, try it. You must be old punk. I told them, no, I ain't no punk, man. I'm a big boy. They said, well, if you're a big boy, then you try this. I tried it the first time and nothing happened. I should have walked away. I'd have never been here tonight if I'd have walked away. They said, man, you're doing it wrong. Shawty, you're doing it wrong. You got to do it like this. And they started sponsoring me that day. They showed me how to do it. I got a sponsor. He says, do it like this, this, and this. I followed instructions well. I went through the first 3-4 steps. I started feeling something. And I said, man, this is where I belong. And that led to a whole lot of other stuff. It led to being broke, needing to get more, and stealing your mother's medication to sustain her health. It led to selling beat bags. It led to hustling all night long just to get the next one. It led to getting consignments and not being able to pay the bills, running from this part of Washington to that part of Washington to that part of Washington. It led down some roads that I never knew exist. And I remember this one time. It was November of 87. I was getting high. I had my girlfriend's car, because I didn't have a car then, because you can't keep a car and still use. So, because you'd have to be like buying gas and stuff. And, you know, that's money that you could be getting high off of. So she had a car. And I was supposed to pick her up from work. And here the ironic part. She worked over at the jail. Go figure, right? And I was supposed to pick her up. And I got the car on about the 24th. Of November to pick her up, right? And I said, I'm going to be there because she worked the 4 to 12 shift. I'm going to be there at 12 o'clock. You can set your watch by this. And I was like, you ever said stuff in your active addiction like you really believe that? Like nobody could have told me I was lying to her. Like I really, really believe at 12 o'clock she could have set her watch. But now listen. This is what I done. I went to go just do like $50 worth, right? And I had like taken money, and you know how you start hiding money and you put it like in different pockets and like in your shoe, right? And it ain't a whole lot of money I'm hiding because I'm on it. But it was like I'm psyching myself out because I'm not going to do all of this. And I got to pick my girlfriend up. And when I got to her, it was like the 29th of November. And I walked in the house because like we were living together. Now, I would love to tell y'all it was my place. Right? But I couldn't even keep gas in the car. So I walked in, and the key worked. And I was like, uh-oh. Right? Now, I'm like greasy as lard. Okay? From the 24th to the 29th. I'm like using. Okay? And this is what made me stop alongside there was just no more dope. No more get high, right? No more. Nothing. So listen. The guy whose house it was, he looked at his woman and says, you don't have nothing? And she says, no. And he commenced to whipping her. So now I'm so high, I'm thinking I'm gonna be next. I'm too high to have any fight back. So I remember sitting there watching this go down and saying, God, if you're real, get me now. And I got just enough strength to like get up while he was still, now I ain't help her. He was still whipping on her. And I tipped out. Because I didn't want to be next. I knew I didn't have, you ever been so high you ain't got nothing left in you? I didn't even have no fight back left in me. So, I got out of the house, right? It's the 29th of November. I was supposed to pick my girlfriend up at 12 o'clock on the 24th. I walked in the house, the key still worked, and she was sitting on the couch with that look of utter disgust. Anybody ever seen that from some people that loved you? She had that look of utter disgust. And check it out. I walked in, she on the couch, she looking at TV, and she looks up at me with tears in her eyes, and I'm loaded. And she says, hi. And I said, I ain't high, that's what I'm talking about, that's just why I don't come home. Because you always accusing me of being high. I am not high. You must be high. And I walk back out the door. You know, this thing gets crazy when we're getting close to the end. We start having some real bizarre behavior when it gets close to the end. I walked out and I went over to my parents' house. And nobody was home. And I had a key that could get me in, and I got in. And it was one of them kind of highs, y'all, that they had some, it was like, you know, some food on the stove, and I knew, you know, they wouldn't have had a problem with me eating it, and I fixed this big plate, because, like, I hadn't ate since the 23rd, right? And I wasn't looking as healthy as I do now. So, I hadn't ate since, like, the 23rd, and like, you know, bathrooms are out, you don't wash, and you don't brush teeth and things like that. So you kind of got all that running together, you know? So, but nobody was home to see it. And they had food on the stove. And I said, I'm going to eat. And you know how your head starts telling you, fix all this food? Because, like, you're hungry. And you got to, like, replenish. Because you might have to roll again. So I fix all this food. But this particular high was one of them ones that I couldn't eat it off. You ever had them ones that you just can't eat it off? The food don't have no taste. You take a couple of bites of it, and you're done. So I said, well, nobody's here. I'll go and wash, you know. And I tried to wash it off, and I couldn't wash it off. I just kept, the more I kept scrubbing, the dirtier I felt. And I couldn't, so I got out of the water, and I go into the room that I once used to have when I lived with my parents, and I lay down on the bed, and now I can't sleep it off. Now this is bad now, because I'm laying in the bed and I'm tossing and I'm turning and I'm turning and I'm tossing, and ain't no sleep coming near me, right? And I can't even sleep it off, and your head is rolling like 500,000 million thoughts per second, because what you know you have done was utterly messed up. Like, you have just royally messed up. Like, nothing you can think of can get you out of this. Like, you have used all of the lies. I couldn't even phone a friend to get a lie. Now, Sermon and I have been together since 12 years old. I couldn't even get a lie from him. Like, I'm done. I messed up. So I lay there for a little bit, and I try to, like, wake up, you know, like get out of this and get out the house. And one of my brothers walked in. And I remember just, I don't know where it came from. I says, bruh, I got a habit and I can't stop. And I remember this brother who, as in my earlier years, I used to have a love-hate relationship for two of my brothers, right? Because out of the four of us, I'm the youngest. And two of my brothers are homosexuals. And I didn't like them because you all teased them. Now, in the house, when we would all come in the house, I loved my brothers, and we would play together. And you remember, like, back when we were kids, and you had your little white socks on, and you slide across the little hardwood floor in the house? We played like that. And I loved that about playing with my brothers, right? But outside, because you all didn't accept them, I couldn't accept them. So, but this was that brother that day that says, listen, you're my little brother, and whatever it is that we need to do, we're going to get you some help. That was the 29th of November. On the 30th, we started, they kept me in the house detoxing me, and we got into a program, and a 28-day program led me to the rooms called Narcotics Anonymous. I'm 23. I walked in my very first meeting. It was a 12 noon meeting down at the Trust Clinic on 1st Street. It was over Union Temple in the Circle at the old church on a Monday night. I went to that meeting, and I saw this guy in there sharing. And back then in the meetings, they used to have tables like this, and the smoker sat on this side, and the non-smoker sat on that side, and we would blow smoke in the face of the non-smokers. It was in a dark basement that was dingy, and mold and mildew on the rain days. The rainwater would just run right down the wall. You had to hold your feet up some of those Mondays, because your feet would get wet. But we stayed, and we started recovering. I met this guy. He started sharing. And when the meeting was over, I said, man, don't I know you? And I started naming some places. And he says, yeah, that was me. And I said, well, they told me, man, I need to get a sponsor. Would you be my sponsor? Would you be my sponsor? He says, man, take my number down. Call me every day for 30 days. I said, man, this man is crazy. Now, that's the same dude that used to be on the street. And now all of a sudden he didn't got cute because he didn't got clean, and he gonna tell me call him every day for 30 days, he'll think about it. I said, he must forgot who I am. I'm 28 days clean. I said, you not gonna tell me you gonna sponsor me now? He said, Marvin, take my number down and call me every day for 30 days. And I walked out of that meeting on a Monday night and I called him every day for 30 days. Now, he used to do stuff like this. He'd tell you, Marvin, go to this meeting, be at this meeting at this time, and get up on the front row. Because now, this is what we used to have to do back then. You come to the meeting, you get your coffee, whether you want one cup or two cups, because you couldn't walk around when the meeting got started. There ain't going to be none of that walking around. Common leader was in the meeting back then, and she said, hey, sit your little down. So you get one cup or two cups of coffee. You sit down on the front row, you get an ashtray, and if you're going to smoke, you get your ashtray and you sit still. And he says, do that. And I started going to meetings, he'd tell me what meetings to go to. And I started building up a network, and he'd tell me, meet him at the meeting. And I'd go to different meetings, and he'd say, well, meet me at the meeting over on the other side of town. I said, man, it's a meeting right down the street at St. Luke's, man, why you got me going all the way on the other side of town? Man, I got to catch the bus. He says, Marvin, act like I got some dope. I got on the bus and I went across the town to the meeting. He said, think about it like I got some narcotics over there, Marvin. I got on that bus. And here, now check this out. I knew something had started happening different. Now, y'all have been talking about this God of your understanding. It could be your sponsor, it can be the chair, it can be the group, all this kind of stuff. I had come up in church. Listen, my father went to church, my parents went to church every day, looked like. We went to church on Sunday, like, all day. You go at, like, 8 o'clock in the morning for Sunday school. Then you got 11 o'clock service. Then you got the 4 p.m. service, because in between 11 o'clock and the 4 o'clock, you go over Mother Somebody's house and eat dinner. And then you come back for the 4 o'clock. And then on Tuesdays, you got Bible study. And then on Wednesdays, you got the missionary. And on Thursday, you got prayer service. And on Saturday, you got choir practice. Then you got usher practice. I don't know how I was using, because I was doing all of that. But somewhere in between that, I met the preacher's son, and he was using. So you know, me and the preacher's son had a good time. We was taking money out the offering basket, and we was going and copping. I told him, man, I know a spot we can go to, and we would walk to the place, cop, and come back to church. We would be shaking our clothes so you couldn't smell nothing. But listen. I got to the meeting, and Stan would tell me, go to the meeting. And listen to this. He'd send me over there, and he wouldn't even show. Now, you can't call people like you can now, like where you at. So you got to wait till you get home, or we used to keep a lot of quarters. They wouldn't let us have dollar bills. So, like, I'm 30 years clean, and I still keep a whole lot of change. Right? And it ain't no payphones nowhere. Right? I still keep change. So I would call Stan and I'd say, man, you told me to go to the meeting and you wasn't even at the meeting. Man, you're going to stop playing with me like this. And he says, Marvin, keep coming back. And he'd hang up the phone. But you know what? What he was teaching me was not about depending on him. The group was more important than any one person to depend on. He started teaching me how to depend and rely on the group. He was my sponsor, true enough, and he was a tough dude. But he started teaching me how to depend on the group. Rely on the group, Marvin. The group is very important. It's the vehicle that you're going to need. And I started understanding that as I started, you know, he like not making the meetings. He would be at a whole nother meeting, and he says, oh, you was there. And he could tell me what I had on. I was like, what, he got spies in the meeting? Right? But we was close back then. There was a strong network. So I would make the meetings, right? And then we started doing step work. And he was in a therapeutic community. He worked in one. And back then, you know, like we didn't have, like, because most of us in here, along with me, retired before we started working. Y'all missed that. Yeah. See, like, I had retired, like, early on, and now I have to work, like, really long. Okay, you got it. So check it. So we didn't have, you know, like, most of us went into the therapeutic communities for jobs, and my sponsor back then was one of the ones. So a lot of his sponsorship was like he was still running a group. You know, he was, shut up. You know, take the cotton out here and put it in your so-and-so mouth. And like back then, they wouldn't let us, like, you know, the young ladies. I was 23, so it wasn't a whole lot of young ladies in 23 age, right? So I was looking at the women in the fellowship, and I was, like, clean and looking good. And I would go and talk to you, like, hi, my name is Marvin. And out of nowhere, it's like he would come out the wall. And he would just say stuff like, did he tell you he still lived with his parents? I say, really, Stan? Really? Right? He said, Marvin? And this is how he talked, right? You understand, see you talking to that woman, right? Did you get that step work done yet? Sister, I'm telling you now, he didn't finish that step work. I wasn't fooled with him. He still got some stuff he's working on. And she said, "Bye, you keep coming back." And she leaves. It was tough. It was tough back then. Then God put this woman in my life, Carmelita. And boy, she was this kind of way where Stan talked to Carmelita, but sit your little down. Right? And but she gave me a whole lot. This woman gave me some things, some nurturing that my own mother didn't even give me. My mother was just tough. She was broken in her own places. She didn't have the nurturing thing with her, with four sons. I don't remember my mother hugging me or giving me a kiss. And to this day, I'm 30 years clean, and I go to hug my mother, and she's still stiffing up. I had to tell her, relax. I don't want your pocketbook. Me and Sherman ain't gonna take the pills today. But she still stiffens up because she don't know how to be that nurturing person. You know, I had a great grandmother that lived with us, and she was the nurturer. She was the rock. I mean, she would just pull you on her lap and just like rub the skin off you. She'd rub you so much. Just call you baby. And she was the neighborhood's grandmother. You know, she had a heart like was so big. Like she just loved everybody. And that's how I got nurtured. I didn't get the nurturing from my mom. And in the first step, I started seeing stuff because we started doing step work. And I started seeing things like the compulsion and the obsession to use and what I was running from. Because, like I said earlier, using wasn't about some recreational no more. It was about, you know, now I'm feeling something and I don't know how to process, so I got to get an escape. I got to get away from some stuff. I didn't know how to process the fact that, you know, my father still lived with us. Now, here was the revelation when I got to the fifth step. Now, put a quarter in the meter right there. I'm coming back to my father, so hold that meter right there. But back to the first step. I started seeing the compulsion and the obsession of my thinking and how just out of nowhere you could be having a good day and the obsession will jump on you and it will hit me and it would tell me go and cop. And I couldn't understand just out of nowhere. I didn't even want a cop and I just had to cop. I didn't know. I didn't have tools to say no. I didn't have tools to work with that could tell me that I had a choice today. I didn't have tools that says I can make a decision and turn some stuff over. I didn't have those kinds of tools that I could use, that I could go into some principles, some spiritual principles, and I can counteract the disease of addiction. Because what I didn't understand is that I had this thing called a disease. I kept thinking that there was just some moral deficiency, and it's just something that is wrong with me. I'm not like my brothers. I'm not like my parents. I don't know what it is, and nobody could tell me what was happening to me. But I started working, and I'm working, and we're taking this plane now, and I'm working in this first step, and I'm doing this first step, and I started seeing the insanity in the first step, how powerless I was over my thinking, my emotions, my feelings, and even my decision-making skills. Because I didn't know how to make good decisions. So what I will do was just be a reactionary person. I always reacted on how I felt. Nobody ever told me that the feeling isn't a fact. I felt it and I react. Nobody told me, Marvin, you don't have to make a move. I started seeing in this first step where it was just so jumbled up in my head. Thoughts were just never, I could never pan them out. I'm just always thinking of stuff just how to get the next something to take me out of the reality of what is, the fact that I'm black, the fact that I'm the youngest, the fact that I was born in South Carolina, the fact that I keep lying and I can't tell the truth, because living in denial feels better than what the unfamiliar truth would ever sound like it would feel. Because you didn't talk about the truth on the blocks that I caught from. I went on some spots where we wasn't talking about how you feel, Tony. Well, I think, I feel a little indifferent. No, we was on the block talking about, man, what you got? How can I get it? Man, I don't want a half partner because I ain't willing to share it today. I got whole money. We on the corners, we on spots selling beat bags. We on the spot selling blow. I ain't talking about no, I feel inadequate. My father still lives with me, and I don't understand why. You know what my sponsor said? They take the quarter out of the meter. You know what he said in the fifth step? Marvin, your father still live with you. You know why? I said, no, I don't understand why he kept coming home. He said, probably because it was his house and he was paying the bills. There was nothing. Listen. Listen. I think I know a lot of stuff. I never thought of that. It just never dawned on me. I thought he was like really just want to cramp my style. You know, he just want to be, you know, that person that just blow you high. I never thought that it was his house. That's why he kept coming home. That just never dawned on me. He, you know, this guy used to pray like, you know, he wanted a business so he could take care of his family. And I thought that was so lame. Like, who prays to have a business? You know, man, get out and hustle. You know, that's what you do. You hustle. Go sell some blow, right? And, you don't pray for a business. You pray for the next package. How do we get the brick this time? Right? And he would be praying that he want to start a business to take care of his family. And I'm like, this is so lame. And we had to sit there and, like, you know how we do at the end, hug up? We had to do that. Like, who does that? Like, hug up and pray for a business. And you don't want to, like, hustle? Okay. Well, I'm not going to be here much longer. Right? Because this is too, you know, this is not right. And in that first step, I started seeing, you see that unmanageability of my thinking? How I could not manage that? I could not get ideas together that would make sense. They were always something irrational. And because of the obsession that always was on me, the obsession to just keep going, that thing that drives you to do the next thing more and more and more and more. And because the obsession that has always been on me, it does this to me. I can never enjoy the thing that I'm doing now because I'm so preoccupied about what's the next one. How do I get to the next one? I'm not even enjoying this one because the obsession drives me so strong and the compulsion comes and it just, you ever had the compulsion to just get on you and it just lay on you? Like it just don't even move. And it's that kind of thing that gets me. Now listen, this disease is what I learned is that this disease that makes me dis-ease with me because the inner me is the inner me. Y'all missed that. Now listen, because the inner me, listen to this, it always wants to jackpot me at every turn. It doesn't like me, doesn't care about a day of peace, it's coming back tomorrow, doesn't care nothing about we having fun tonight, it's coming tonight, it knows my flavor. It knows my flavor, and it comes in that. And this is what happens. I stop using narcotics. I had a sponsor that was good, so I didn't use people because we started seeing that in step work. So listen, over the last 2 years, I ain't always looked like this. This became my flavor. Strawberry shortcake. Watch this. Watch the enemy. I go back home, we got a Safeway. I don't know if everybody knows what a Safeway is. It's a grocery store. We got a Safeway. And they make the best strawberry shortcakes you can find until I found this woman that Sean John hooked me up with. Now listen, I was copping strawberry shortcakes so much they knew me by my name. I would walk to the bakery looking behind me to see who's behind me. I'd go and I'd get one and I'd eat it before I get home. Tomorrow I'd stop. I'd get two because now my wife is saying, you're starting to gain a couple of pounds. So I get two. One is for her. You know how we do. We broken people break people. I get two. And she said, well, it's all right. I don't like it like that. I said, well, you know, you can go ahead and give me the rest of it if you're all right with that. So I'm doing mine and I'm eating hers. I go the next day, I know she don't like it like that. So I said, well, I'll just get one and share. But this is what I would do. I'd get two, I'd eat one in the car, and I'd get a bottle of water, and I'd drink the water to wash it down. So I'd take the one home, and she and I split it. One day I'm cheating, and I had some white icing on my beard. I didn't know. I walked in the house. Go to greet her, give her a kiss, and she said, you've been eating strawberry shortcake. No, I haven't. She said, yes, you have. It's right there. No, it ain't. I don't know what that is. And I'm wiping it off while I'm talking. But I want to tell you, this disease doesn't care anything about us. If giving us diabetes is what it takes, it'll do it. If giving us high blood pressure is what it takes, it'll do it. Giving us stress, it'll do it. It doesn't care that you're not using tonight. This thing takes on many forms and it manifests in all areas of our life. It's spiritual by nature. This thing ain't just gonna get us with narcotics. But if you don't practice these steps, you will go back to the familiar thing. I started doing the second step, and I started seeing what the first step, all of the insanity of the first step. And what I started seeing in that first step was now it's time to go to work. What my sponsor started doing was in the first step, because see, the first step does this to us. It starts to take us to a place to show us who we are. So you know when you go into the surgery, the first step is the anesthesia. It starts to put you down and it starts giving you a sleep now. Now it's going to take you and put you into a sleep. So in the second step, what you start to see in the second step is that I could be restored. I believe that this could happen to me now. And in the second step, you start to see with some of the insanity in the first step is not happening anymore. Because you remember when we first got clean and how it used to be when you start praying to the Creator, and before you could stop the prayer, the thing that you was asking the Creator for, He was already giving it to you. Well, now listen. The longer we stay, He don't give it to us that fast now, because He says, I'm taking you somewhere else now. So we don't get that thing as fast as we used to. But we came to believe, because what the word came starts to implicate is that we never arrive to a place of insanity because we have that we came. It did not say that we come, that there is a completion. Came and simply implies that we never complete this because we have to keep coming. Because if we stop the coming to believe that we can be restored, then we go back and we unplug ourselves from the anesthesia that the first step took us through, and we go back to the place that is familiar to us. Now, in the second step, we came to believe, and we start seeing experienced members start sharing their stories. And you start seeing, like, it's Friday night, and you got $20 in your pocket, and you ain't thinking of getting high. Oh, yeah, you coming to believe some stuff now. That's big for us. When we first, if you're a newcomer and you got $20 a night, you stay close with somebody. Because we still coming to believe this. But you start seeing that, and you start seeing that there's a little bit of manageability in my thinking and my feelings. I'm not as reactionary as I once was when I was still in the grip of this disease of insanity, this disease of addiction, that the grip is starting to loose a little bit because I'm keep coming back. And I'm starting to believe in sponsorship. I'm believing in a home group. I'm believing in a network. I'm believing in the literature. So now, because I have all of this, I have a plethora of ammunition now, that the first step doesn't overwhelm me the way that it used to. But when I stop working the first step, then I'm back into the behavior of the strawberry shortcake. Now. You get to the third step, and the third step talks about we make a decision to turn our will and our lives. And I didn't understand this thing called my will. What is my will that I turn over? And how do you just turn it over? How do you just trust in this power? How do you trust in this God of your understanding? And how do you do it is because you start to see some things that had happened for you in the second step, that there's some restoration in the second step. Because what the Creator starts to do in the restoration process is that in restoring you, is that where you stopped and left him at, he takes you from there, and where you should have been is where he placed you. You kind of cut the line now because you're working with some spiritual principles, and because you got spiritual principles, you're able to cut the line and start being restored to a place like, and you start seeing family members at the family reunion, and they start saying, oh man, you look good. Oh girl, what you done your hair? What you do to your hair? And you start saying, it ain't the hair, it's the steps. Because what they start seeing is a restoration taking place in your life. They start seeing a transformation. They start seeing the steps start to come alive. You start talking like the fellowship now. You start talking like the information, the literature. You start saying things that your sponsors say to you. You start helping family members out. And they be like, oh, what's wrong with you? Because, see, they don't understand what we have in here. This thing is like magic in here. It's not magic, but it is as if it was magic. This is how it works. You start looking at the second step, and you can't even explain how the restoration process happened. You don't know when the craving stopped. You don't know when the obsession and the compulsion stopped. You don't even know when you was able to walk with that $20 and did not cop. All you know is that there was a Friday that did happen, and I still had $20. Now, I'm making this decision to turn my will, and what's my will? I'm new, and I don't understand this will thing. And this will to turn something over to a creator, a power greater than myself. What is the will? What is the will? What is the Creator's will for me? I don't even understand his will. And so I can't even understand mine. But I'm trusting this process that what you all keep telling me is going to work for me. So what I start doing is turning over my thinking to the fellowship, to experience members that can guide me through the steps of this program, that can guide me through the literature. So I start turning things over to them, and I start saying, well, you know how we start sharing, well, I was thinking about doing this, and then you got experienced members and sponsor can tell you, well, that's not something you should do right now. You know, I was 3 years clean, and I started going to my sponsor and telling my sponsor, I'm ready to get married. And he says, well, if she never changed, can you still love her? And you know, when you think you're in love, you go, yeah. And guess what? There's been some days in this marriage when we both looked at each other and said, you know, I don't know why we did this. 25 years married, 27 together, and we still together. And it's a direct result. It's a direct result of this program. You know, we get to this fourth step and we start looking at this asset and this liability. And we start making up this list. And I start, you know, the sponsor started telling you. And the way I did mine was friends, family, and relationships. And you start looking at those categories and you start writing about that and you start seeing different patterns and different defects of your character and how we think stuff is good when it's ultimately it's just bad. It's not even good for you to have. But in this fourth step, you start looking at assets and liabilities and you start writing them and it becomes painful because we never stop. I never stopped in all of my years. I never stopped to look at me. I always started looking at the outward appearance. I started looking at you, and if you would just do what I say, it wouldn't be like this. I couldn't understand in that fourth step where the women that I had become so abusive, physically abusive to the women that I was dating, what I didn't understand was I was seeing my mother, that same little woman that used to beat me and tell me take my clothes off because she's not going to whip her clothes, and I vowed that anybody that would ever talk to me like she did, I'm jumping on them this time. This time is going to be my time. That stuff that I started seeing in the fourth step, I started seeing in relationships. I started seeing in families. My first sexual encounter was with a cousin. And you hear this. Even though it was with a cousin, I didn't feel bad. I went again. And those were things that I vowed I would take to my grave. There's no way I can tell somebody about this. And I got with my sponsor, and we started doing fifth step work. And my sponsor started telling me things about him, and here's what he said. Now, this is something I walked away with. It is no way, Marvin, there's 7.3 billion people on the planet. You cannot be the only one. I'm here to tell you tonight, you are not the only one. Whatever it is. But I started seeing that kind of pattern, that kind of behavior. In that fifth step, when we started to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, I started getting a little bit of courage to talk about some of this stuff. In that fifth step, because now what the fear is saying is that if you tell this, man, they going back to the meetings and tell on you. You can't tell nobody this kind of stuff. But I was able to have a little bit of courage because you all taught me in that third step to have this trust, to make a decision to turn my will over. And I started trusting in this high power that was greater than me. So I was able in the fifth step to talk a little bit about some stuff that was deep and dark, some broken places that was in my life. And I started telling it to my sponsor in fifth step. And my sponsor started talking back to me and finds out that we have more things in common than different. And I'm walking around for years still getting loaded, thinking I'm the only one like this. And I found out I come to a place where we all are some special people. There's no one of us are having a unique story in this room. I started looking at the sixth step, and in the sixth step, we started looking at defects. And why make the list of the defects from the fifth step? Why do you need to hold on to them? And the only answer that I had was, they were still my survival tools. And my sponsor started telling me, we ain't just surviving in here, we living in here now. Now we're living. So some of these things I was getting tired. You ever been clean long enough to get tired at you? Your defects are so glaring that it makes you sick. Oh, so I ain't the only one. Okay. So they were starting to make me sick. I used to speak profanity out of my mouth like a sailor. And that was one of the things I didn't want to keep doing. I used to lie for no reason. That was one of the things I didn't want to keep doing. I used to cheat in relationships. I didn't want to keep doing that. I used to be physically abusive. I didn't want to keep doing that. And I started writing these things down as a character defect. And me and the sponsor started going over them. And why am I keeping it? And I didn't have a reason why. It was just the fear of the unknown. I thought profanity made me sound like a big boy, because on the blocks I came from, that's all we done. But this is what he started telling me. We ain't on the block no more. We in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous, learn how to be better people. I got here, I wanted to be better and not bitter. So in order to be better, I had to be willing to give up some stuff. And some of the stuff I was willing to give up was some of the defects of my character, because I didn't have to learn how to survive no more. Because I'm in here learning how to live a day at a time now, and I'm enjoying the fruits of the labor in here. I'm talking about freedom far beyond my imagination. Now, I'm six step, I'm working, life is starting to happen and show up. I was telling Tony a little early in 2005, dreams do come true. We're down here in Ocean City at the convention, and I get a phone call from my oldest daughter, and she tells me, "Daddy, Mommy just fell out." They were in Richmond, Virginia, and she fell out, and they didn't know what was wrong. I just did a workshop, and a bunch of us was down at the bonfire eating. We was crab legs all over the place. And you know how you can be kind of selfish? Like, the call came, and it's like, why you got to fall out now? I'm eating. Well, it turned out to be serious. In 2005, she fell out, and she had a brain aneurysm. Let me tell you, I got 5 minutes, and we're going to bring it in. She had a brain aneurysm. But this is the relationship with the Creator. I left Ocean City and I'm heading to Richmond. And I'm praying. And when you have a relationship, and this is the 11th step, when we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out, you start forming a relationship. Because after we start developing this relationship, after we start developing this conscious contact with Him, we start coming off of our knees and we start walking in the will of the God of our understanding. And because that relationship is formed, and because I got a deposit that I can withdraw, in 2005, I withdrew on the deposit of the relationship with the Creator of my understanding. And what I told Him was that because I had just done this for you, you can't take her. And there my wife sits right there. But now in the 12th step, it says, having had a spiritual awakening, what we start to do is to start carrying this message now. This message is what? Any addict can lose the desire and find a new way of life. Now listen at this. It's not just any addict, because as you start to live this program and as the pages start to come alive in your life, what starts to happen is that your family starts to ask more of you. They start to depend more on you. That you start impacting your children and your grandchildren. Because of this program being in my life and it's alive, listen at this. My daughters are now in college and being productive. They ain't slinging on no street corner, right? My oldest daughter carrying for 8 straight semesters a 4.3 GPA. I didn't even know they go that high. I think I was a 2.2. this program comes alive to us, we start impacting people. You start going on your jobs and in the workplace, and things, the atmosphere starts to shift and change because you are on the job now. People start coming to you, asking you for advice, how to help them out. You know, your family members don't make a decision until they talk to you, because this program called Narcotics Anonymous is what you live now. This program called Narcotics Anonymous has brought us from the guts of life, from the trenches, deep down out of the trenches, to standing tall and upright, and we can make good, sound choices and decisions today. Narcotics Anonymous has changed our lives. Because the literature, the pages has come alive. We have embraced them. And listen, in my closing, I've already got the warning. In my closing, I just want to leave us with this. It says, this book, it is meant to help you determine your own interpretation of the principles contained in our steps and traditions. We hope you will find personal growth, understand, and empathy in the following pages. We pray you will be moved to a new level of insight into your recovery and the valuable place you occupy as a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'd like to thank y'all for allowing me to share. My name is Marvin, and I'm an addict.